Welcome to MacGuffin. I'm Alex, and with me, as usual, is James. You can go to our website to check out our previous content. We most recently talked about movies like Con Air, The Manchurian Candidate. We did an episode on Lock, Stock, and Two Smoking Barrels and Snatch, two movies, one episode. And before that was Dunkirk. I've also written a couple things, one about comparing Detroit and Dunkirk and how they show historical events on film and the differing approaches. And I also, you might get a kick out of this, I've re-edited Jason Bourne, the most recent Bourne movie. Ooh. To make it, it's about 7 minutes shorter, just cutting out all the little annoying things. So I wrote something about that, and also we'll be posting that shortly. But yeah, so you can check that out, MacGuffinMen.com. Also follow us on Twitter at MacGuffinMen, and that's it.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. And now, here are Alex and James.
All right, James.
Yes.
We are back. Back from the theme song.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Back talking about a movie from America's foremost fidatalist. Philatelist? Bennett Miller?
Philatelist.
There yes. It is.
Yeah, Bennett Miller. This time around, we're talking about Capote, but that was a deep Foxcatcher cut, I believe.
that is the part of Foxcatcher that I remember the best. yeah, Foxcatcher, I think, is his least impressive of his three films by quite a bit, but it's still good, if only for that scene, which is amazing. But yeah, so Capote.
Bennett Miller has directed Foxcatcher most recently, before that Moneyball, another movie we did a podcast about. Mm-hmm. And we've worked our way back to Capote, his kind of big feature film debut, right?
Yeah, as far as the narrative feature. And also this is just where he sort of comes on the map. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I guess we'll note now, also written by Dan Futterman, who wrote Foxcatcher as well.
Okay, yes. Yep. Good call. Based on this was based on a Gerald Clark book, another biography of Capote.
Layers and layers of adaptation.
Yeah, and I mean, this isn't even, I mean, we've seen Cold Blood, In Cold Blood adapted for film and television, and we can mention Infamous, another 2006 Capote In Cold Blood joint around this time, too. So,
yeah, Capote was 2005.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But right around this time. And yeah, I mean, Truman Capote was this huge figure. It gets talked about in this movie, being phrased as In Cold Blood made him the most famous writer in America. And some people are saying he might be even one of the most famous figures in American pop culture at the time, after the book was released. And he was someone who was very present in culture. He was very much a personality, Truman Capote was, we'll put it that way. Mm-hmm. And just had a very, he had a style to him, and a look and a personality, and a way to speak, and was obviously very good at his job. And this biopic, would you even call this a biopic?
I think yes. It's okay. Like a portion of a life biopic. You know, there's those two different types of biopics. The sort of you know, cradle to the grave sort of biopic, the more Ray style of thing, and then this is the most important portion of this this person's life as it relates to us, you know, as viewers. So we'll just show this part.
Yeah.
And this is the type of biopic that I vastly prefer, which I've made very clear over like 800 podcasts. But
yeah, do you want to, I mean, we'll say briefly reiterate that, just particularly in what Capote does well by taking the other approach?
Well, the Cradle to the Grave sort of style of biopic is just so, it's so generic and so formulaic that it's just hitting beats, right? Whereas this movie, I think, surprises me. You know, like, it doesn't necessarily go the way that you expect it to. I think the guilty verdict comes in at about the 38-minute mark. And we don't get a lot of Truman Capote. Well, we don't get any Truman Capote before the timeline of this movie starts. We get references to his past, you know, so we get the details that are helpful and interesting and sort of provide you more background on him as a person. But they don't give you, you know, flashbacks to the defining sadness that happened in his childhood that makes him want to eventually write In Cold Blood, because that's always so hacky and stupid and never actually really seems to be true, you know, like just because somebody's brother gets cut in half doesn't mean they're actually going to start writing music. Like, those things aren't directly related. And those types of annoying things are just removed from this type of movie most of the time. Yeah.
Right. And so that just allows the structure of the film just to be a bit more experimental.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And this movie, this movie is also so, I don't know, I feel like this movie is so one of a kind, because I just feel like there are just layers of questions that exist throughout this movie that I, just based on the, purely on the structure of the idea alone, and that's what I think I find the most interesting about this movie.
Yeah. So what are those big questions for you that this movie raises that you enjoy about this movie? Or do you just want to start with your appreciation of this movie as a movie first?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's a fantastic movie. like, I would imagine you agree, right?
Yeah, I liked it. I liked watching it, and I have enjoyed thinking about it and researching it quite a bit, and that's always a good sign of something put together with a lot of thought, not just to be kind of breezed through and be entertained by.
Yeah, exactly. And it's a type of movie where there's just a lot of professionals working. You know, nobody too flashy. Even though Philip Seymour Hoffman's playing such a, like, by nature flashy person, he somehow manages to avoid being too flashy while doing it. And, you know, Bennett Miller, also not a very flashy filmmaker, but very talented, and knows... is very good at restraining himself and also being stylish and creative in sort of subtle ways that I feel like a lot of filmmakers don't have. But there is this sort of there's this weird line that he walks between being obviously talented but never so. He doesn't have that Soderbergh type bone in his body where he's like, look how cool I'm being right now. You know, it's just, he just does it. And if you think about it, you can find it, but it never gets thrown in your face, you know? And I think that can be said all through, like, you just look at the cast too, you know, you've got Bob Balaban, Catherine Keener, Chris Cooper, Amy Ryan, just people that are never flashy, but are always amazing at what they do, you know?
Yeah. I only watched this for the first time recently. And obviously I remember Philip Seymour Hoffman was in this, but.
Oh, and Clifton Collins Jr. Another good example. Anyway, continue.
Yeah. No, I forgot, I think, literally everybody else who's in this movie. And this, as you said, is some very talented people, some people I love. Like, the powerhouse cast just keeps on coming and made me very excited as it was revealed how many people I like were in this movie.
Yeah, exactly. And had you seen this movie when it was released in theaters, you wouldn't have known who Amy Ryan was. Like, when I saw this in theaters, Amy Ryan didn't mean anything to me, you know? Like, because this was before I would have watched The Wire. I think her season of The Wire would have aired like a year previous, but or her most prominent season of The Wire would have aired. But yeah, this now, certainly in 2017, it's nice to see Amy Ryan, knowing her from all those things that we've seen her in the past 10 years.
Yeah, but I think it's important what you say about this not being a particularly flashy movie, and that this is a very good movie, as you said, with a very talented group of people in front of and behind the camera, but it just exercises a lot of restraint. You know, as you said, we don't see the tragedy that that some people would easily like to link up to the genesis of Capote's talent. It is talked about, but it's not talked about in really, you know, dark detail. It's not done quickly, or it's done pretty quickly, and the violence is only really shown at the end. You know, there's all these things that could be put at different parts of this movie to kind of hook you immediately, and that's not done. It really is a really good slow burn in a lot of ways.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the reason that they save the violence until towards the end is that jump to the flashback which again, a movie with not a lot of flashbacks. This might be the only one where Perry starts telling Capote about what happened that night. What happens at the very beginning of the movie is we see the aftermath through somebody who knew the victims, who is sort of a like an emotional victim in her own way, because she finds the bodies, right? So we're seeing the crime
and we only even see one body.
Yeah, exactly. And we see the crime through a human's eyes, as opposed to just seeing it from the terror of humans that are about to be murdered, right? So by the time we get that flashback later on in the movie, we know a little bit about Perry as a person. So we're not introduced to him as a murderer. We're introduced to him as a suspected murderer for sure, and a probable murderer, but we get to know him more and more before we actually see what he did, you know. And then that flashback, yeah, that cut is just very jarring, because, you know, we get Perry having a nice casual conversation with Capote about very dark things, of course, but then he says, and I remember thinking he was a very nice man right up until I slit his throat. And then we get that cut to the flashback, you know, and that just sort of that cut is almost like the middle of that sentence where he says, I remember thinking he was a very nice man, you know, Perry just being a human. And then the second half of that sentence is Perry being a murderer, you know, until I slit his throat. And I just think that's a really, really effective way to do a flashback, especially when you pick your spots with a flashback, pick your spot with a flashback. And it also just doesn't, we don't prejudge Perry as much as we would if that scene existed at the beginning. And this movie is so much of this movie is about trying to avoid prejudging people. You know, people talk about first impressions fairly constantly in this movie and the importance of them. And I think that the movie does that in a sort of show instead of tell sort of way, I think is really cool.
Yeah. And obviously all movies, I mean, are supposed to escalate. But this, you know, it's this very nonviolent movie that gets, you know, pretty awful as violence for that part near the end. And also Perry's execution is pretty jarring and showing pretty straight on.
Yeah.
And there's also this emotional violence that happens, you know, very, very strongly towards the end. We have indications throughout the movie that Capote is not the nicest person. I just feel that this movie doesn't lean on that kind of stuff. It gets you interested in the story with, you know, just good filmmaking and some great looking shots and some fantastic performances. But it's really the end where the physical violence and this emotional violence kind of comes. Like we see Capote really hurting each other people and really hurting himself at the end of this movie. He's sort of he talks in a way that's kind of callous about people throughout the movie, especially in the second half of the movie. But it's really at the end when, you know, he's very flippant about Harper Lee's success because it's not his success. And just the way he's going, just essentially drinking himself to death near the end of the movie. It manages to keep you, you know, intrigued and interested throughout, but then it really hits this point home at the end really well. And I just find that it's already a good movie, and it succeeds in ratcheting things up in an earnest, effective way that it's, you know, it's earned by that point in the movie. It's not, I just don't find it really exploitative of this man's life or these other people up until then. And it's just a really good guttural punch at the end to drive so many of the themes that they've been playing with for the 2 hours previous up until that point.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to talk about the way that the drive points home at the end, you know, the last line of this movie is Harper Lee saying to Capote on the phone is, you didn't want to, implying you didn't want to save them so that you could finish your story, so that you could use their story for your own gain. And you know, with the that being the implication. And then the last thing we see is Capote on a plane flying back to New York, and he's looking through Perry's diary, right? And so that's such a humanizing thing, is that Perry was a person with a diary, just like one of the victims earlier in the movie. Capote gets to go through their diary with Harper Lee. And it's just sort of the, again, the idea that the line between victim and murderer just isn't that you know, these people aren't that different. They're just, their actions are, you know? And I just think the way that this movie sort of is able to try and say that all of the humans are kind of closer together than the term murderer and victim would have us think. I just think that's really good and really nicely driven home with that last scene of him holding Perry's diary.
Yeah. And so what do you think this movie is? How does this movie make Truman look throughout? Like, is this a, because we were talking earlier about the standard biopic, which sometimes is, you know, I mean, every story is sort of rise, fall. Some of them are rise, fall, rise again. Some of them, especially with biopics, it's this tragedy that starts their career, and then they, you know, start to achieve more and more success. Then something bad happens that tests them, and then they're able to rise up again. Do you see a straight up and down trajectory to this, or a straight downward trajectory, or how are we meant to feel about Capote throughout the story?
I don't really view this movie as going really up and down. I just sort of, again, it's sort of a slice of life biopic, so we just sort of see this slice of life and aren't really given too many cues as to how to feel about Capote as a person throughout. We are left to make up our own minds, and the dichotomy of him being this very entertaining presence, this very engaging person, when we see him mixed with, like you said, some of those comments that he says, especially in the second half towards other people, that really sort of paint him as a self-interested person. That all sort of combines to me to sort of just be like, well, everybody has their contradictions sort of thing. And the thing that I find the most interesting about this movie isn't so much thinking about how the movie paints Truman Capote specifically, as it is about painting people that sort of come in from another part of the world and then use part of an experience that they never get to feel, like coming from New York to Kansas in this movie, to use that as an example, and to sort of use this world that they don't really know all that much about for their own personal gain, right? And that's the thing I found the most interesting about Capote, and this, it almost feels like that might have been the genesis of this, is wanting to do something about somebody traveling to somewhere they're not from and using those people's story to benefit their own life. And then the story of Truman Capote just happens to be the most notable example of that, you know? So I think that's what makes this a really successful movie, is that I don't think the idea was necessarily, hey, we should make a movie about Truman Capote, so much as it was, hey, we should make a movie about somebody who uses a true story for their own benefit, you know? Does that make sense?
Yeah, the,
because that, those, like, that is also the story of Truman Capote for sure, but yeah. That is just sort of how I feel about this movie. Yeah
so what is it about him, his sort of New York personality coming to Kansas, that illuminates that?
Well, okay, so our introduction to Capote is at a party, right? Like, we get that brief intro with the bodies being found in Kansas, and then we get a shot of the from when we cut from the body to those pictures on the in the house of the victim. I think that's like a fantastic cut when we just see her portrait of her. Unbelievable. Yeah. Cut. And then we get a cut to a field in Kansas, and then we cut to the New York skyline, right? And then we cut to Truman Capote at a party telling a story about a conversation he had. I think that's the scene where he's talking about having lunch with James Baldwin. And, you know, he's just entertaining and telling stories about his life. And then he wakes up the next morning, the party's over, he's told his stories. What is he going to do at the next party? What is he going to talk about? He needs to have more experiences that he feels are interesting enough to talk about at these parties, right? And he reads this newspaper article and decides he wants to go to Kansas to research it, right? So basically the movie is about Truman Capote going to Kansas and using Perry Smith's life, most specifically Perry Smith's life, because we see him talking to Perry Smith more than anybody else in this movie, but also Dick Hickok and all the people in Kansas as well, just sort of using their experience for his book, because he feels he needs a story to tell
and because he has run out of stories that he has self-generated, so he's looking elsewhere. And we also get a nice other side of that, where we get the idea that Perry might be kind of using Capote just to get a better lawyer for his own appeals, right? Using his friendships with Capote there. And then we get this wonderful meta layer of it, where Bennett Miller is a filmmaker making a story about Capote, Perry, and the victims. I don't know if those the photos that we see of the victims, both in the house and of their dead bodies, are the real photos. It certainly looks like it might be. And I just think that is really interesting, that because it feels like a really self-conscious move on Bennett Miller and company's part to sort of say, we know we are making a movie about all of these different people, and we are benefiting from our telling of their life story. And we feel a little queasy about this, but it doesn't mean it's not worth telling in this way. And I just sort of find that really interesting. It's such a self-conscious movie, in a way that it never really gives you answers on how to feel about these things, but it just sort of raises a ton of interesting questions, you know?
Yeah. What you were saying earlier about him, the search for stories for him, he tells these stories, as you said, at the cocktail parties and in New York with these socialites and, you know, celebrating breakfast at Tiffany's and all this. And then he goes to Kansas to try to, as you said, kind of garner more stories, create his next work. And he uses the detective's wife, who he says has an interest in fiction, as his way in. And then he regales her with stories about Humphrey Bogart and Houston and all this stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's using that as currency to further his collection of knowledge on this Kansas story, what's going to end up being in Cold Blood. And when he speaks to, I think he's saying it to Perry, but I might be mistaken, but he was saying how people have always judged him his whole life because the way he talks and the way that he is. And, you know, he definitely has just this unique look and this unique manner of speaking. And the idea that he is so celebrated in New York City, but wouldn't be if he didn't have these stories. You know, if he wasn't a successful author, if he didn't have these novels and these screenplays to point to, would he fit in there too? Somewhere it looks like he fits in so well, and he's, you know, everyone's laughing at him, he's very funny, and he's, you know, makes all these jokes off the cuff, and he's very entertaining. It's this back and forth of storytelling. You know, it's this currency that he uses to go from New York City to Kansas and, you know, all these other places where he's written. And he just collects these stories with actors and actresses and socialites and farmers and detectives. And it functions even just within his life. There's this sort of meta level to it that doesn't even broach what you're talking about with that Bennett Miller and the filmmakers are doing here.
Yeah, exactly. And that conversation that you mentioned, that isn't to Perry, that's to the girl that gives them the diary.
Oh, yeah, so yeah.
It's before he meets Perry.
Yeah.
But yeah, I agree. Just wanted to make a correction known.
Sure.
in a story that involves some potential corrections being needed anyway, for given the controversy around In Cold Blood over the years. But yeah, I know. And it is interesting the way that this movie shows storytelling as a currency, like you said, and also Capote's need to or a difficulty fitting in, and we see examples of you know, people looking at him in a certain way in Kansas, in the sort of "you're not welcome here" sort of way, that vibe that you get. But that doesn't only apply to Capote as well. I think the movie does a really good job commenting on Harper Lee's place in literature without specifically doing so. Like, just the idea that Jack misremembers the name of To Kill a Mockingbird when he's passing along his congratulations for it getting published at the... I forget where it was, but the it might be towards the end, where Harper Lee's To Kill a Mockingbird has been published, and a man says to her, her book was fantastic, but he didn't even know that she wrote. And I just think those very small notes sort of help place her more in the story as well, you know, just with these small moments.
Yeah, that's something else I want to bring up. I mean, this movie takes place about over 6 years, I think. And Harper Lee kind of, you know, writes this book, has it published, has it turned into a movie, attends the premiere, all within just this small trajectory of this one work that Capote does, right? Yeah. And I think it's very interesting that, as you said, you know, there's kind of just two scenes about it. And she's kind of had this whole gigantic arc in writing a seminal novel. And the way that Truman Capote, the person, seems to be so selfish and so focused on what he's doing and what he's working on that Capote, the film, really overlooks this, I think, is another nice meta piece of storytelling as well.
Exactly. And that To Kill a Mockingbird is at least on the level of In Cold Blood as far as how it's remembered, if not the more remembered book of the two, you know, like, I think that is what makes it really interesting. It's not just that Harper Lee wrote a book. It's that Harper Lee wrote To Kill a Mockingbird, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just this idea of watching the story take place of, you know, I think initially we like Truman, you know, especially just his first scene, especially juxtaposed against this gory scene that we've seen in Kansas of, you know, a young girl finding her dead friend having been, you know, taking a shotgun to the head at some point in the very recent past. We see him having fun, and he's a funny guy, and he's dressed well, and everyone seems to really like him. And as the movie progresses, I think that I think I might have a slightly different reading than this on you. I think that we are, I think it's more of a downward trajectory for him, or at least we're supposed to like him less and less as the film progresses. I think that it is a slice of life movie, and that it does come with a complex character who is good and bad simultaneously in a lot of ways. But I think that our appreciation of him, in my reading at least, is that we're supposed to like him less and less, and not just that his life obviously gets sadder, but I just think we're supposed to like him a bit less. And I think it's his treatment of Perry. You know, we like him, and then it becomes clear that he is using Perry more than anything. And he essentially says he wants him to die. You know, I don't think there's a ton of ways to really read that. I genuinely believe he likes Perry at the beginning, and he obviously sees something of him in Perry that, you know, draws him towards him just as a person he can relate to. But he turns on him just essentially in this exchange for a satisfying ending to this book. And it just becomes clear that he cares more about the success of his novel than he does about this person. And I think it's interesting that he initially really does like Perry. You know, I genuinely believe that, and cares about him, and turns on him for a satisfying ending, in the same way that we initially like Truman and we turn on him because of his need for a satisfying ending. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah, I see that. It's just sort of, I think the, I think what happened here is that I saw this movie once when it was in theaters and hadn't seen it again until I watched it for this podcast. And I think it's that jump from Kansas to New York at the very beginning, and seeing somebody immediately, or our lead immediately regaling people with stories of his time with other famous people. You know, I think I just saw that scene and thought that was so interesting, and then spent the rest of the movie thinking about that. And like, I never saw Truman Capote as depicted in this movie as so much of a person that I'm supposed to care about as much as just this figure that represents somebody going through the real world trying to find stories to tell over gin and tonics, you know?
Yeah.
I think that just might be my own mental block, because I agree with what you're saying. I would just say I'm just thinking that the amount of time I've put into thinking about this movie as a whole is quite a bit, but thinking about specific people in this movie is very minimal, I would think, you know, even though the name of this movie is the name of our lead character, you know. I've just sort of only focused on the ideas, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that there's definitely enough, I think, for that reading as well. Even just in, I mean, you can apply this to the man Capote, but I think this works for the kind of artist dipping his toe into the real world kind of thing when he says, "I don't care whether you catch him or not," to the detectives. You know, this is it's so out of, like, this is literally what they do is catch them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But he's so focused on the drama of it and just the idea of what I can put together out of the pieces that are here, more than your community wants to put back its community from the pieces that these murders have shattered it into. Yeah. And I think that works for your reading as well as my more personal character reading of it.
Yeah, exactly. You're exactly right.
Yeah, and I love that he just him saying that, you know, when he's talking about the visitation, how he feels he should be an exception to the rules.
Yeah.
I think I should visit them right now and anytime that I want for as long as I want to. And yeah, I think, again, that works for both. Just this idea that someone, and maybe part of it is that the time that he did spend not famous, and then he used this tool of him being such a fantastic writer to shape his childhood, you know, just in reading about some of the writing he did when he was younger and some of his breakthrough stuff, it's so just not autobiographical. And he's talked about how he didn't realize how much he was revealing of himself at the time. He thought he was just writing stories, but this was really this form of therapy to write these semi, if not almost entirely autobiographical novels. And maybe that's the thing that he was able to get away from that life with. And so that the idea that he moved to this other level because of his ability to do that, maybe he feels he can step out of it just briefly in order to immerse himself in these worlds long enough to take what he needs to provide the next novel, to provide more fuel for him to stay in this upper-class jet-set society that he's come to know and love so much.
Exactly. And I mean, the end of the movie again is Capote in a plane. He is literally traveling to his next potential story in the movie, you know. Like, however, I don't think that the destination of that plane is ever really pointed out. I would assume it's New York, but that it's not plainly spelled out is just sort of interesting, that story that he came to write is over, so he's in transit to the next one. And I just think that's really interesting, you know.
Yeah, and for a movie that is kind of ostensibly about having a hard time writing a novel, it's not the writer's block nightmare film that we've seen so many times. You know, it's not him writing something out, ripping out the page, crumpling it, throwing it in the wastebasket, you know, trying again. It's not the mere frustration of trying to tell any story. It's watching the emotional effect that it has on him. And, you know, I'll use this quote now just to try to explain what I think it means, but I'd like your idea of one of the quotes that closes the movie, that more tears are shed over answered prayers than unanswered ones. Mm-hmm. It seems that he's, you know, he gets what he wants in the end, and that's finding out that that's what he wants is what seems to crush him the most. These realizations that he, you know, when Nell says something to him, like, maybe you didn't want to save him, whereas everyone kind of thinks they want to save as many people as they want, as many people as they can, I mean. But he realizes, or perhaps he realizes later on in life, that in writing the story, he so valued his own success, even over, you know, justice for these murdered people and the life of Perry, you know, wanting just wanting the appeals process to end so he could kill himself. So he could be killed so that Capote could finish his novel, you know. That I think that's what we're watching here. We're not watching the frustration of an artist, but the deterioration of a human trying to be a great artist. And, I mean, succeeding in being a great artist, but sacrificing so much more in exchange for that.
Exactly. And I think your reading on that, the epigraph of his unpublished last book, is correct. I agree with it entirely. And also just to point out that We never see Capote struggling with writing in this movie. Whenever he is sitting in front of a typewriter, he is just typing. We see him with piles of research next to him, but he is never... He doesn't have the Donald Kaufman scene where he's just like sitting there talking about how he wants a blueberry muffin, or Charlie Kaufman, I guess, is that scene. You know, it's like we just don't have that scene. And even when he's talking about the writing process, even before he started writing, he's like, I can see the book in my head. It's always confidence. It's like I'm really onto something, and there's just never a moment where he is sitting there being like, oh, what should I write about Perry now? You know?
Yeah, no, it's true. I was kind of focused on the fact that there's not too much of that, but I think you're right that there's none of it.
And no, there's
he
none.
Looks he always looks very confident and comfortable writing, and he's got a drink in hand and he's by himself, but he seems very content with what he's doing. And you're right. He says things like, you know, when I think of how good my book could be, I can't even breathe. Yeah, he's not struggling as a writer at all. This is so much more about him struggling as a person. And I think that's probably the loftiest goals of all films about artists of any kind. But I think this is just one of the ones that does it the most successfully.
Yeah, exactly. The writer's block replacement in these movies is, like you pointed out, him waiting for the end of the story to happen. It has nothing to do with Capote's actual work on his own. You know, once the ball is in, the metaphorical ball is in Capote's court, he can kind of get things done relatively quickly, is what the movie says to us.
Yeah, and I think that I think part of why I think this is more fun fun's probably not the right word for many parts of this movie.
The part where the guy addresses his Sears hat is definitely fun.
That was very good.
It's fantastic.
No, but I think maybe why this movie is more fun to, or more enjoyable to think about than it is to, well, not more enjoyable to think about than sit through, but provide so much more when thinking about it. Or provide so much when just thinking about it, not necessarily watching it, is that he doesn't even seem to be aware of most of this stuff. It's, again, maybe near the very end, it seems some of it seems to be hitting him, but mm-hmm. it seems more that we're supposed to appreciate his deterioration much more than he does. You know, he's succeeding in a lot of this novel, especially when he gives the previews. You know, he does some early readings of his books and things like that. And as we said, he's very confident writing. He seems very comfortable when he actually decides to sit down to write. But we've watched him kind of sell his soul and destroy himself while succeeding. And I think that that's so much more pleasing than watching someone try to write a song and failing, or smashing their instrument, or, you know, smashing their typewriter because they can't do something. They're so good at doing something that they've lost so much of themselves in the process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, okay, so it is interesting that something that I think this movie has a fairly standard opinion on alcoholism in general. You know, it's just we see Capote drinking a lot, and eventually we see Capote dying from drinking. Well, we don't see his death, but we get it in text on screen. But I think it's interesting that as the movie progresses, as the story of Capote's inner thoughts progresses, as you described it, we see him falling deeper and deeper in alcoholism. And as he falls deeper in alcoholism, he gets closer to what I would consider the truth of the movie, is that, like what you're pointing out, Capote isn't necessarily a good person, and what he's doing isn't necessarily totally ethical. You know, like he is waiting around for people to be executed so that he can sell his book that will end up being a very popular book. And I just found that.
And pretending to find a lawyer, or yeah. Claiming to have been looking for a lawyer.
Exactly. And I just think it's interesting that the movie simultaneously has this very typical biopic depiction of alcohol, where alcohol just makes life worse. That's just how it is. And just this very sort of conservative outlook on it. But it also does sort of lead Capote to a more what I would say is a more logical line of thinking at the end, in that thinking about what he's doing, you know, as you've discussed it. And I just think that is kind of interesting.
Yeah. He makes a realization, you mean?
Yeah, he makes a realization about what he's doing, and that he is not necessarily a good person, but he realizes that only after he started to drink more, you know. It sort of helps him. Alcohol like kills him, and also helps him get closer to the truth about what he's doing within Cold Blood. Yeah.
I don't know. I just see alcohol in this one as this as a magnifier. Like it just makes good times good and makes bad times worse. You know, I think the cocktail parties are what he likes and is part of what makes his idea success. And we don't see the downside of his partying while things are going well. I think him drinking with some of the people in Kansas gets him to reveal or gets him to access more information, has people reveal more things to him. And, you know, even the one time he is nice enough to celebrate Nell's success of about to kill a mockingbird, you know, they share some drinks together and it seems to be positive. But it's after things really start taking a downturn and he, what I believe is mixing JTS Brown with baby food. is that what's happening there?
That classic Friday night move.
Yeah, that's what I see is this. This downside, like after a certain point has been reached, and is there something I'm missing with that baby food stuff? Like, what is that? Can you explain that to me?
I cannot because I don't have anything on it other than he just had it as leftovers from when he bought Perry food earlier in the movie. I don't know. I don't have a read on it.
Yeah. No, I didn't know if I like missed a scene where I don't know, but anyway,
because it's not like he returns to like alcohol brings him to like sort of this infantile state. He's still doing very adult things, you know. He's a lot of the time bedridden, but he still does get himself out of bed and exist in these very adult situations. So I don't think if they were trying to be like Capote's a baby again because of alcohol, then I don't think that works.
Yeah, I mean, there's the general idea just that he's regressing. Just that he's achieving less than he could be by doing nothing but drinking. And there's also perhaps the idea that the way that he revived Perry, you know, when he was kind of doing his hunger strike in jail, he sort of kind of revived himself. But he's so far gone at this point that he doesn't understand that the positive nature of what's in baby food is going to be more than undone by mixing that much hard liquor with it.
Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, yeah. I guess we're not solving the baby food thing, but we're trying. We're trying, Bennett.
We might have to make some of our own and see if it clears anything up.
Yeah, next time we hang out, we'll watch movies and eat baby food with whiskey in it. Sounds like a great time.
No, it doesn't.
But yeah, I think as far as what you're saying about alcohol being a magnifier, yeah, I think you are right. And I think what we did is, I think we both said, you offered more detail with the positive times. I think what we're both saying is kind of different versions of the same thing. So I agree that you are right, you know? I just don't think I'm necessarily wrong.
No, I agree. And it's also probably bears mentioning that it's the late 1950s and early 1960s.
Yeah, exactly.
Where a certain amount of drinking of hard liquor was just more than acceptable.
Exactly. All right. Sorry.
No, just speaking of the time period, and just the notion that I brought up earlier, that being one of the most successful authors in the United States also made him one of the most famous pop culture figures in the United States. That's very much a time that's passed now, eh?
Oh, for sure. Like, Seth Meyers has writers on his talk show, but he can do that because nobody really watches Seth Meyers other than A Closer Look, you know?
Yeah.
It's just, like, whereas Truman Capote was on Johnny Carson a lot, you know? So, yeah, that is a time that is gone. I mean, as somebody that values writers and the written word, it's a bummer for me, but I don't know, so it goes, I guess. I don't
know. Yeah, well, why do you think that went away? Do you think TV just got so big that, and I mean partially the internet, but I feel like by the 80s and 90s the idea of a A-list author is kind of gone. And I mean, there can be exceptions to this. I mean, I was trying to think of who some of the most famous authors right now are. And quickly, I got to J.K. Rowling and George R.R. Martin, but that's as an effect of what them being able to kind of cross platforms and do something else. In my lifetime, I remember, you know, like James Frey or James Fry, who wrote A Million Little Pieces and then got in trouble with Oprah. Like some of those novels kind of get big, but they're kind of more human interest stories than I think some of the big novels of the past 100 years really are.
Yeah.
Is there anyone I'm missing on like the current pop culture landscape?
No. No. So what I think what causes this is just in general the progression of society and entertainment options that we have, right? Reading, I think, it's just like it's more difficult than a lot of the and I don't mean this as like a holier than thou sort of I read ipso facto I'm better than you sort of thing. I mean it sort of as if you don't authentically love reading, then once another option comes along, you'll pick that other option, right? Like once there are more options on television that don't bore you, you'll start watching TV more, which starts to happen in the 80s and the 90s with the proliferation of cable. And so in back in the 60s, the 50s and 60s and before that, you just had so much time to kill that like reading was sometimes the most entertaining slash easiest option to kill that time. Whereas that just sort of disappears, right?
Yeah. In this movie, people go to the theater to watch somebody read.
Exactly. Which is just so mind boggling. Like I have gone to book readings, you know, the number of people there is like, at most has been 60, you know, and those also are not done in theaters, you know, like, so I think that's just what it is. It's just that more options exist. So you stop doing the thing that was harder, you know?
Yeah. It's just,
if you don't,
a lot of forms of entertainment.
Exactly.
Now.
If you don't authentically love it, then it will fall by the wayside.
Yeah. And just because I know this is a book that you had read, Chuck Klosterman's X, he talks about Jonathan Franzen, the author, and that The Corrections was his masterpiece and it might make him the best living author in America right now. And like, I'm reading that book right now. I wouldn't recognize Jonathan Franzen if he walked down the street past me, you know, this guy who's kind of seen as this literary giant among people who care about literary giants is still a pulp cultural dwarf, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guess David Foster Wallace is a good example of somebody who was like borderline famous as a writer, you know? But yeah, also true. To a very certain subset of person. And, you know, we're jumping back 20 years to the time when he would have been on like Charlie Rose and stuff. So
yeah. And the internet wouldn't have been what the internet is.
Yeah. Yeah. Because he created the internet with infinite jest. I do enjoy, I mean, we've talked about this a little bit. But I do sort of want to point something out about this movie that I think is just sort of worth mentioning, because I do think this movie Capote is very empathetic towards pretty much everybody. It just sort of paints everybody as a person, from the victim to the murderer to Capote, to people in Capote's life like Harper and Jack. But I think something that is worth noting, and I mean, certainly doesn't devalue the movie to me, but is just sort of interesting in that Perry is, you know, it's mentioned that his mother is Cherokee, and Perry is played by somebody of Mexican descent, you know, and Clifton Collins Jr. has a long career of playing characters who are quote unquote vaguely ethnic. And I just think it's kind of interesting that in this movie that is so so specifically at times about feeling empathy for people unlike yourself, I think it's interesting that they sort of just missed that one entirely, you know? And I just think that's interesting, you know, and worth pointing out.
By not having an actor of that ethnicity?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And I mean, that's also, I think Clifton Collins Jr. is fantastic in this movie. I just,
he is really good.
He's really good in this movie, and he's really good in everything. That's just how that's how it works with Clifton Collins Jr. He's a fantastic character actor. And this is just his most, this is his biggest role in something that, would be really prominent, or like would be sort of a thing in our lives, you know? But yeah, I just think that is, I don't know, worth pointing out.
Yeah, no, it is. And speaking about the movie as one that focuses on empathy, and slightly touching on something I was saying earlier, we fall for Perry, and we fall for Truman, and Truman falls for Perry. And I think it's this idea that it's easy to empathize with certain people more than it is with other people. And, you know, Truman is, I think he's funny and he's stylish and he's charismatic and he's obviously very smart and talented and interesting. And I think that's why he wins us over quickly. And I think that Perry, you know, he's seen as sensitive and artistic and he's handsome and he wins us over the way he wins Truman over. And I just think that there's some danger in that empathy, because those aren't traits that necessarily make you morally a good person. And mm-hmm. I think by the end of this movie, that kind of gets proved out. You know, we always want to believe Perry didn't do this. And then when we were pressed on the details of it, we learned that he did do it. He did it more than the other guy that we're kind of less likely to trust had a part in it. And Truman is this, you know, towering intellectual figure, but I think by the end of this, more people come away with a negative perception of who he was as a person to the people in his life. And I think it is a movie about empathy, but I don't know if empathy is always the same thing as being a truly moral actor, you know?
No, I agree. And I think this movie, like, because what you were describing is that nerdy kid from art class can't be a murderer sort of thing. And it's you know, it's so tied to image and what we think about these types of people, just because of how we've been conditioned to think about these types of people. These artistic people are just these harmless little butterflies that write books or do sketches in notebooks, you know, whereas Perry is an artistic person and Capote isn't exactly the most morally clean person in the world either. And I just think it's interesting that that exists in this movie, that so much of it is about image. And I mean, it's amazing that we've talked about this movie for so long without talking about the use of cameras in this movie, given that that is something we are frequently drawn to like moths. But there are a number of scenes in this movie where we are forced to, well, not forced to, they're good scenes, but where we watch characters watching other characters be seen by other people in the movie. You know, we've got our first introduction to Perry and Dick when they're being walked into jail past all of these people and these cameras. We've got Dick and Perry getting their photos taken and Dick not realizing that he shouldn't laugh, but also the photographer saying weird things. So it's like, what am I supposed to do in this situation? When you feel awkward, sometimes you smile or laugh, you know? But he doesn't realize that this isn't a situation where he's allowed to smile in the public eye, you know, because people will see this picture and be like, oh, he's a murderer. He's smiling. He's just perfectly evil person, you know? And then even later when we've got depressed Capote, but he's going to Kill a Mockingbird's premiere, he's sitting there in the car with Jack and he's like borderline got his head in his hands, steps out of the car in front of cameras, and he has to flash back to Truman Capote from minute 5 of the movie because he knows cameras are looking at him. And I think that's sort of just the idea of both the manipulation of image and also just what we come to expect from people, to tie back to the artistic person can't be a murderer sort of point, is that it's a lie, you know, like there's no real truth in these images because these images that we see in this movie get contradicted by other moments in the movie, you know?
Yeah, and I read in Cold Blood. I don't know.
We get it. You read books. No. You're better than us.
Yeah, I'm blowing up your spot with this one. I read it about 10 years ago.
Oh, so you're so far ahead of the game. Anyway, I'm sorry.
I'm old school reading Capote. and it was just rethinking about my experience with that novel after watching this and thinking about it and researching for this podcast, there's near the end of it, there's a Robert Service poem, which is a really great poem called The Men Who Don't Fit In. And it's, you know, the title's pretty on the nose about what it's about. It's about the, you know, just men who don't fit in and don't feel like they have a spot in society. And it's a well-written poem, and it's one that I really like, but it's one that its use in the novel in Cold Blood really is designed to soften your opinion on Perry especially, but the two murderers in general. And that's such a good summation of the point you're making, that like, well done art or, you know, this air of sensitivity and creativity around someone can kind of not even distract from, but excuse away some of these negative features within these people. And it's just not morally justified. And I think that this movie really kind of explores that idea, especially the things we're talking about of Capote never struggling with his art. Capote always being a fantastic writer when he was able to, or when he chose to write, but it not saying anything about the moral character of who he was.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I, another thing that we just haven't talked about is Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is kind of crazy because this is really his movie and probably one of the iconic roles of his lifetime, right?
I mean, yes, in that this is the movie he won an Oscar for, so it is his iconic role. But I just don't, when I think of Philip Seymour Hoffman, I don't think of any one role. Because you asked this in an email, and I was like, I know he won an Oscar for this movie, and he's obviously fantastic in this movie, but he's also obviously fantastic in every other movie I've seen him in. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it helps that it's a starring role.
Oh, well. for sure. Starring
in small roles.
Exactly. It's like another character actor of a, you know, lower profile, but around the same time, I guess it was 2004, Sideways came out and Paul Giamatti was a character actor playing a lead. So that becomes his iconic role just because that, I think that's the only time he's really played a lead, you know? And but when I think of Paul Giamatti, I don't think of Sideways specifically. I just think of Paul Giamatti character actor, right? And Philip Seymour Hoffman is a much better actor than Paul Giamatti, who is already a very good actor, you know? But when I think of Philip Seymour Hoffman, I think the enduring thing about his legacy is that he could play everything so well sort of leads to him not having an iconic role. And it also doesn't, now that he's dead, it doesn't feel odd watching any of his movies and thinking like thinking, oh, I'm watching a dead person perform, and a person who died in a very sad way. I never think that when I'm watching his movies. And I think it's just because he was able to sort of draw a line between Philip Seymour Hoffman, the person, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, the actor, that a lot of actors just can't do because they're not talented enough. I mean, I don't mean to be disrespectful, but like when I watch 8 Mile, you know, and I see Brittany Murphy, I like the distance between Brittany Murphy, the person, and Brittany Murphy, the actor, is much closer together than Philip Seymour Hoffman, the person, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, the actor, just because Brittany Murphy was less talented than Philip Seymour Hoffman. So it's just harder to remove yourself from the idea of thinking, oh, it's sad that Brittany Murphy's dead. And I think that that's something that is so, it's unfortunate that I had to be kind of mean to Brittany Murphy to make this point, but I think that's something that says more about Philip Seymour Hoffman's career, that he doesn't really, in my eyes, have an iconic role. It's just that he was just the character that he was playing in the movie, and you remove him from a movie and he's just Philip Seymour Hoffman, the guy that can do anything in a movie, you know? And I just think that's really cool, and I couldn't really think of another actor that has that, you know. I remember when we did a podcast on Magnolia soon after Philip Seymour Hoffman died, or maybe like the week before he died, I forget, maybe this was in our network podcast, but we compared Philip Seymour Hoffman to Robert Duvall as sort of this character actor who is great in everything, but bounced around a lot from different types of roles. And even Robert Duvall has Tom Hagen. Like, he will be remembered as Tom Hagen. Yeah. And I just think that's so impressive that we are comparing him, Philip Seymour Hoffman, to a screen legend. And what I'm saying is that he's so legendary that he doesn't have an iconic role. His iconic role was just being amazing all the time, you know? And I just think that's really cool.
Yeah, and it reminds me of I don't know if you saw that David Fear of Rolling Stone, his quote about Philip Seymour Hoffman.
I did not.
After he died. Nope. I'm just going to read a part of it because obviously he had a lot to say after he died, being such a huge actor. But he said, no modern actor was better at making you feel sympathy for fucking idiots, failures, degenerates, sad sacks, and hangdogs dealt a bum hand by life. Especially when he played them with all of their worst qualities front and center. And I think that's another crazy thing about it, is that how many unlikable characters he played, or mm-hmm. like either bad people or just sad kind of losers, as he says, like people who you usually wouldn't see yourself getting behind, but it's done so well. Like I, even other than him being a leading actor, I was thinking about him compared to George Clooney, like just as a character or just as an actor who, you know, he's good looking and he plays characters who usually just evince his politics and presumably the politics of a lot of people who go out to see George Clooney movies. And I think it says something for Philip Seymour Hoffman that you can like him so much when he's playing such bad people and not not necessarily like the badass villain, but just kind of a piece of shit. Like, and it's I think that's something really remarkable about him too. And along with the fact that everyone says he had this incredible work ethic and that so many talented directors and actors always had good things to say about him and always chose to work with him. I think it's, if it does go down that Capote was his big one, I think it was a good one because again, he's willing to take some of the negative stuff and put it front and center, still make it sympathetic and likable and still do a really great job of doing it, but still getting something substantive out of the role in the process.
Yeah, exactly. And when you talk about him putting, you know, being able to play less likable characters and making them likable, he built his career on being good at playing unlikable characters. Like Scent of a Woman is, I think, his first most prominent or his first prominent role. And he's just playing an asshole in that movie, but he's so likable. And Hard Eight is another movie from the 90s where he's doing the same thing. And it's basically until Boogie Nights and Magnolia where he's able to sort of start playing more normal people. I mean, I guess calling anything about Boogie Nights normal is a little weird, but you know what I mean.
Even in that movie where so much stuff is cool, he's not cool at all, right? Like yeah, exactly. He wants so badly to be cool and he's so clearly failing and you still like him so much.
Exactly.
And I think that's remarkable.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, my favorite movie that Philip Seymour Hoffman is in is The Master. And that is like a perfect example of somebody who is being an entertaining asshole and super likable. And I mean, the whole movie is built around being unsure about how you think about this person, you know? And I think Capote is another good example of that, as we have talked about so much over the past hour plus, just that he was able to play unlikable characters and still make them likable, you know, which I think is so key for this this specific portrayal of Truman Capote, you know.
Yeah, and if you're going to do a slice of life movie about someone who you're not sure about how to feel about, you need someone who is talented enough to do this nuance and this complexity, and that's what we got here.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not, there are not a lot of years in the Oscars where I wouldn't be would be unannoyed with David Strathairn as Edward Murrow losing the Oscar, you know, and this is just one of the few situations where that worked, you know. So yeah, Philip Seymour Hoffman was awesome. Capote's a good movie, and it's amazing that Bennett Miller has only made 3 movies, but these are the breaks. So thank you for listening to the MacGuffin Man, and be sure to check back next week.